Mr. Gormley, Reel 27. You're now in a new position in Abyssinia, which you've just been describing.
Could not believe my eyes when I looked at it. I thought, no way anybody can get anything out of that. You can stand there forevermore. So we had to get cutting in any case. This was the last stronghold. There was nowhere else to go. There was nowhere else it could go. The rest of the thing was I handed over to Haile Selassie then, because there was nowhere else for anybody to go. This was the actual last stronghold. So we started selling them this, you know, doing what we could and that, you know, and eventually climbing up and getting knocked back and getting knocked back. This was going on the day after day after day after day. Maybe a month. And suddenly, seems they know we wanted to surrender. We wanted to surrender, but we wanted to surrender and still hold our arms. Yeah. I was trying to think of the correct designation and I couldn't think of it for a moment. But they can carry everything we lying down with them for me, like I said, but they're long ago they surrender. So the Duke of Leofta was in charge, and he marched the whole lot down out of that mountain top, and he marched them all down, and they came down into where we were in the bivouac area at the bottom, where they put up light and piled all the alarms and everything like that, and then they marched a lot of them to capture it. And you know what? Just like I was saying earlier on, there's always a lucky strike. You can do what you want. And what had happened was that they built all this reservoir you could drink through in the rock and everything. Built petrol stores and everything. And one mistake they made, they put the petrol store above the water. One lucky strike in there hit the petrol. There was only little apertures in the light of the film test here, that was on. One lucky strike got in there, blew the petrol store, and the whole lot put away in the box of crime. And that was it. It could have been there. Yeah, but there was no reason why they couldn't be. And that was it. And the whole lot got there.
And during the campaign, you'd been firing the guns as well, hadn't you?
Oh, yes.
You'd been on the guns as well as driving.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Oh, yes, that's what you did. You had your guns and that, like, you know, but you always kept them reasonably close together, you know. I mean, it was the easiest, simplest thing in the world. You did about 200 yards, and you hit the wagon up with the wagon and away, like, you know.
What date would this be now? What year?
I'm not positive about it, but I can easily find out. I just checked.
And what year was it? 1941. So what happened next after they'd given up and you were obviously going to move elsewhere?
This is what happened. From my point of view. Because for weeks, I picked the bubble from there. Nothing I hear was passing straight to me. I was determined that I said, I'm sick of finishing this. There's no way I'm going back there. And he laughed at it, cut me off. And he said, this was just while we were waiting to come in as far. And he said, are you all right? I said, yes, sir, I'm all right, sir. Are you sure? I said, yes, sir. But anyway, he must have noticed, like, as time went on, you know, like, when we finished, like, and he came up and he said to his wife, stuff like this, and said to him, he said, right, Gormley, you never know it. Every day, really, right, Gormley, There's something wrong with you, isn't there? I said, yes, sir. I had it again, mate, didn't I? I must have been making good skin and bones. She said, go and see Captain Brady. So I went down and saw him. And he, just took that as a bed. Went on down and I went back to Asmara. Stopped at Asmara for the night. And I went back to Agadat, where I was still a first aid station. And I got stopped the night there. Then I went down to Kassala and stopped the night there. I went down to Batana Bridge, where the big hospital was. Well, I was put in hospital there. And this MO came down, you know, took a specimen that night. And I said, I'm afraid he said, you've got enteric fever. He says, but, he said, how long have you had it? And I'm thinking, it's weeks, you know. He says, well, he said, you survived so far without anything. He says, you can survive the rest. He says, you've got to do without. Nothing to eat. Nothing. No. And I thought, bloody hell. And because I'm sure that's what it kept it going, like, because I was still eating, even though I was going straight forward, like, I was still getting some benefit out of it. Like, so, anyway, I'm in this very hospital, and the scouts are sitting there in the road, RESC. And he said, what's the matter? I said, Avon, I said, get me some curry bananas, anything we can out that bloody canteen. I said, of course, I want to eat this. I'm bloody starving. Well, he said, I'm chewing his soul. I said, I'm not going to get that one. I said, I'll give him another bloody one. I said, get me anything you can out of there. So he went and he got some curry bananas back, and I ate that. And then there was a fellow in there from the Free French. So he went in there. And he was we had some Calvin tea beer from it, and they'd given him, he was on a bottle of Whitbreads every day. But he didn't like it. He only put that much in a bottle, and he threw it up the water. So this scout got to go. So he went and he got the pretty Whitbreads off him. He said, oh, hi, and he was peeling right. He got the Whitbreads off him. So we'll share them with the Whitbreads and all.
This is stout, is it? Whitbread stout?
Stout. With red stout, and so we were sharing that in all of it, you know. And anyway, I went down to Four Stone Street, you know, and which was partly bloody with it like that. I must have looked like someone like out of belt when I looked at it. And even the parson could be making one day, he could be, I'm sure the kid would be able to last really right, you know. And I thought, oh, we're going to see it, and I said, you don't need to worry about me, I'll get out of this pretty bed. Don't worry about me. Don't you worry about me. I said, I'm all right. He said, oh, well, you know, I'll cook you. I said, well, then just keep what you want to say for yourself. I said, I don't want to know about it. I said, I'll get out of this pretty bed. I was saying that to him.
And how long did it take for you to recover?
Well, about a month. And then I started putting weight on. And, It was only 130,000 gets over it to you, and tell it through. And he said, right, he said, then I've got my weight up to about 6 stone. And then you'll go to the right, he said, right, he said, you're improving, he said. I said, I will be, I said, I'll improve that pretty bad if I get out of the way. Right, he said, would you like to go down to Camatoon? I says, yeah. I said, good. And I was still pretty weak, like, I'm like a kitten. And this fella, another lad that was in there, who was coming alongside him, the lad out, who was your measurement, a lad called Thompson. And funny enough, he was a scout, and another. And he said, they'll look after you. So we got on the train and out from the town of Bridge, we went down to Khartoum and went into, and I was on what's called 10C bed down. That meant I could lie in bed all bloody day if I wanted to. Nobody could have. Nobody could tell me to get out of it. Nobody. And I was on 10 shillings a day for another 3 weeks, and I started paying money again because what they did in the UK, I was giving £2 a milk a day, fresh milk every day. I was doing it for the future, you know. So I had £2 every day. And every week, and for me, it was pretty much it.
So how long were you there?
So I was there for about 3 weeks, 4 weeks, into the fourth week, and we had more cool like they said. Well, he said, I think you're strong enough now, he said, to make you go back to the Delta. So I came back. I mean, I travelled first class and all the Tennessee bed down all the way, you know. And I come all the way back from Khartoum, up the ocean, onto the boat, and then back up the Wooden Off Point, the train. And I finished up in hospital in Cairo. And when I got in the hospital in Cairo, I went in there and December came around and the examiner was like, and he said, anything wrong with your leg? I said, only my legs. And he took a look, and I don't remember, he just took a look like that, and he just went like that because it was bare, like, you know. And he just went like that. And he showed me up there and said, what's the matter? He wouldn't tell us that, I said, rest. I want you to rest. I'm telling you, he said, I think you've been doing too much. I want you to rest. I don't know what you're doing. He said, because I've often done that. It was important. It's quite a lot. When I press it in, I think I keep going. It didn't. It just didn't stop him. And so I was about 23 weeks in there again. And he came on after that, like, you know, when it just quieted down, as soon as I'd stopped walking, I'd be looking down the road, and if he walked me, I'd over-exercise, you know. And I was sent to the depot, Dalmaza, Cairo, Dalmaza, and which was the big artillery depot there. So from there, you could be sent anywhere. So they sent light duties, and they must be light duties. So I went on light duties once I went down Marder. All I was doing was A to B, take this from A to B, this box. Just gathering bits of bloody paper and walk down from A to B, B to C, can I get the canteen on the cook table or whatever. So it was quite a good style, actually. And anyway, I was down in Cairo. I went down to the Esbekeyya Gardens this night, and I saw three of the lads sitting there. Where the hell are you? Oh, he said, we're back in the old camp, the greener. I said, the old camp? He said, aye. Oh, I said, aye, aye. So I said, right. And I jumped on the wagon, and I went up to the tram, I should say. And I went up to the camp, and Bucky Dunant was there. He was over Sergeant Major, like a head sergeant. And that was the one we got in Hyderabad. He said, I said, can I see Major West? Yeah, he was pleased to see us, right, you know. I said, can I see you, Major Bastard? He said, why? I said, well, I said, I'm on my group, you can go in the depot, right? I said, but, I said, I'm sure I'll be able to swim if I can get him to ask us. I said, if he asks for me personally, I said, I'll come back in 1 minute. So, that's what I did. When he saw that one stuff, right, you know, he was over the wall at the same time, like, you know, he was doing it. what are you doing here? I said, it'll be, if you ask for me, I said, I'll come back to my own regiment. If not, I said, I'll go to some other regiment. Any other way. And, which you did, you know, once you got in the devil, you could be sent anywhere. You could have been sent out that way, or whatever. And, so he did. He asked me to be sent back to him, like, he said, that is doctor, the doctor, it's the doctor's room. So I had to go and see him. I had to go and see the MO then, like, so I went and saw the MO, and I said, I think I'll recover better. I said, he's running back along with my own friends. I said, oh, I've been for years and years. I said, I'll be far better off with them than the people I don't really know. He said, are you sure? And I said, oh, aye. I said, no problem. I said, I feel quite well. I said, I'll start picking up whatever I need to. I said, I'll soon pick up, no problem. And I went back to the old bed.
And what happened to you there?
Well, I got there, and the first thing that happened, I'd just seen Bunky Dell the day before, and I got back there, and he said, well, chap, I'm pleased to see you back. And he said, but he said, I'm just leaving you. And he went, the way he went, he went on and off too.
And how long was the battery in its base camp?
It was only about 3 weeks, that was all, just refurbishing. And that, you know.
And then presumably you moved out then?
And then we moved up to the desert, went away to the desert, and you know. Went up to the past Martin, the bush, up into right up the front there. Because by this time, Tobruk was on the siege. And we were trying to relieve.
So you'd be on the frontier with the Germans just across them,
yeah,
presumably?
Yeah, yeah. So we went to the road.
And which division were you with now? Which division were you with?
5th Indian. Still with the 5th Indian. And we'd gone up there, and we went across the wire. Oh, I remember that. The night we went across the wire, I saw the most vicious thunderstorm. It beat any battles you could ever see. any barrage, anything like that. Any thunder was banging and cracking it. And we had 25 pounders then.
Oh, you'd got your 25 pounders then?
I forgot to mention that, like, Matthew, because this is what they've been down here for. They handed over the 4-5 howitzers to the Australians. And that was CDFWs. And we've been given these. The Canadian thing, Chevrolet. We've given the Chevrolet room to her, which to us wasn't a patch on what we'd already lost. The Canadians got all these lovely CDFWs and we proved them in the desert before we ever went up there. And when we'd gone all through these mountains and everything, you know, right away up there. And they proved themselves time and time again. And now we've got these Chevrolets and 25 pounders. And I have this very big circular thing stuck underneath them, which is supposed to make it easy for you when you want to do shift your targets, like, you know.
Like a pivot to it, you could pivot round them.
Circular pivot underneath on the board, so you could just pick it up and walk around with it, you know. Which did make it easier. But that's all right, as long as you've got bloody level around the front. If you stand on a bloody rock like that, you're trying to hit. So we used to fire with a bloody thing tucked up instead, you know. And in the end, we took the bloody thing and brayed the bugs off like it. It was easier to fire without the dumb things.
What was the 25 pounder like as a gun?
Oh, well, a gun is a gun, kind of style, you know. To us, that was a good gun. It was a good gun, very good gun, actually. A very good gun. And we had extended range at about 13,000 yards before we only had about 8,000, because that was broken down, you know.
And did it fire high explosive and smoke,
yes,
and so on?
We had high explosive, armour piercing, good armour piercing shot on it. And we had two different types. We could find, put them on with a delayed explosive, or you could have an impact explosive, you know. So they were quite very good. They were very good. Anything was stop the tank.
And they were using the anti-tank roll as well.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And the crew, were they the same number as...
We were on the crew, never varied, you know. You always had the odds and sods who were like more or less reserves, you know, in reserve all the time. Because they were all the year casualties. You can't do without casualties, you know, they were all the casualties.
Did it have a protective shield on for the crew?
Yes, it was a protective shield. It's only bullet protection, that's what it was. It didn't stand it down more than a bullet, that's all. But normally, three or three. If you got anything heavier, like such as the boys' anti tank rifle, or anything heavier than that, it would
come straight through.
It would just come straight through. The only thing is, it was handled like that, so if it did hit, it would either go one way or the other, you know. And so we had this terrible thunderstorm, everything was very bombed down. I remember that. We had to wait until very daylight, so it finished, and then more like dig ourselves out and wait until very sand dry, let them get a full of water and get them out. And we set off up to a place called Womar, Libyan Womar. We got up through there, and the pretty tanks took off from there, because the Germans had did this one, and we went through the country, and they picked them off by the city.
Was this part of Auchinleck's offensive to try and relieve Tobruk?
Relieve Tobruk.
Which was towards the end of 1941, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, as I say, when the thing of Libyan Omar, the city of Omar, we had quite a couple of battles there. We let the New Zealand was way down on our left, and the Aussies were way up on our right. And we went through there, and the others come in behind us. We had to really turn around and go back where we came from, but at the same time, we did the same as they'd done. We put another bloody man through down and let them run off. And we picked them up before they could go out of order, you know.
Who were you essentially firing against?
Anybody that looked very suspicious.
Infantry, tanks, and so on.
Whatever occurred. The infantry would come in on the tanks, and then they would debouch, and they would be attacking you, you know. So he just took what came as it came, you know.
And were you firing the gun again? Had you been trained to?
Oh yes, I was on the gun mainly now. Yeah. A driver had taken over for me.
Oh, so you're on the gun now.
So I'm on a gun.
And as a bombardier corporal, what were your duties on the gun?
Number two on the gun, yeah.
And what does a number two do?
Well, it's second in command. You're in command in case a sergeant gets a knock, like, you know.
But your actual operation on the gun, what were you doing?
Operation on the gun, at the time, I was a side there. Because nobody could beat me on the side.
Yep. How did you lay the sights then? Can you tell me?
Well, you get your angle sight came down, which you put on a chronometer, and then try to think of the sequence now. Bloody hell, after all those years, you think it comes straight to your mind. The angle sight was on that. Little sight down there, and that gives you the angle of sight. This was then you got the chronometer, which was given to you from the OP officer, and saying down like X number of degrees right or X number of degrees left, and then you would put this on, and then you sat that one, and then you would have a name and point handle the site right, which meant that your site was correct, and then you were all ready for the to give it the old click and the way it would go.
And you fired it, did you?
You actually fired it.
And was it a trigger device of some kind that fired the gun?
No, it was just like a pull lever on the top. Just like pulled it like that, and you should leave it straight up, you know.
And presumably the whole team had this sequence to lay the gun ready for you to fire.
Well, you see, you had the number one who was in charge of the gun. You see, they always kept me as they put me on the side, because I don't know why, probably because I was the best one along. I'd been trained as a sight nearly, and I was always on the side. Until I became in charge of the room itself, which was many years later. And of course you had open sights, then you just had like a telescope. Just like that.
And did you get into action at this time on open sights at all? Did they get that close to you?
Oh, yes. As we let them in onto the target site, you see, when we run in onto the minefield, as they had done was just previously, and they were sitting ducks, and we were just sitting potting them up like five, you know.
And were these tanks or infantry?
Yeah, tanks. Jelly tanks. Yeah.
And you fired the armour piercing, did you, at the tank? Was that an anti-tank shell? What was the shell that you fired at?
Yeah, with us, we had anti-tank shells, but having said that, we had flown by experience that if you put the, what they call the cap on, leave the cap on, instead of making an impact, like which detonated an impact, if you left the cap on the shell, right, and you fired that, you could ball it through the bloody tank that would explode inside. And we found that out by experience. And so we always, if you were in that thing, we used to, instead of the armor piercing tank, the armor piercing shell, I should say, was a sharp pointed object. So you had to hit it exactly right, otherwise, because it went to a point like that, you see, so we do it through. But the 420s were putting the lead in the cap in. It just said, put, and it just bore it through the tank. And it would explode inside.
This would be the first time you'd met Germans, and how did you find them as fighters?
Oh, yeah, well, I mean, you only saw them more or less at, not close range, like, I didn't do any hand-to-hand fighting with Germans at all. Not that I can remember of, anyway. And not like we did it on the front here. We had to do a really hand-to-hand fighting there.
Yes, they'd never get that close to you, yes, presumably.
They never ever got that close to us, like, you know. I mean, there were times we ran for it, like, which I had to occur later on, like, you know. But times when we had to abandon guns and everything, you know. But we weren't close enough to the hand-to-hand fight. Not like the infantry. They were up on the, what they call the shitty end of the stick, you know. It was them, it's the old saying, it was them or us, no problem.
And you'd be working in close relation to your own infantry battalion?
Yes. You had your infantry with you all the time, like, you know. I mean, you had what they call mobile infantry, you know, which they had the guns, weapons and guns and that, and not guns, I should say, but they had particular guns, like, I had 2 pounder guns and that, they had to do it that way. But they put the jellies out, like a flea, like a biscuit, like, you know.